This is Understanding Israel-Palestine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This program reflects the views and opinions of its hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of its members, staff, or underwriters. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's show. I'll be speaking today to Madeline Cherugino, a spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, about settlement expansion in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, about Americans for Peace Now's call for U.S. aid to Israel to be conditioned on Israeli behavior, and about its response to Amnesty International's report this month that Israel is an apartheid state. Our conversation took place February 8th. But first, news. Israeli soldiers shot dead a Palestinian teenager this week during protests near the town of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 17-year-old Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiya as troops, accompanied by a bulldozer, arrived on Sunday to demolish the home of Mohammed Jaradat, a man accused of killing an Israeli settler late last year. Scores of Palestinians from nearby areas came to the village to protest the home demolition by Israeli soldiers. Dozens were injured by live ammunition and rubber-tipped bullets fired by Israeli soldiers preventing the entry and exit of vehicles to the village, including ambulances of the Palestinian Red Cross. The soldiers demolished the floor of the house where Jaradat's family lived. Pushback continues against Amnesty International's recent designation of Israel as an apartheid state after a four-year study of Israeli laws, policies, and practices. Even before it was published, many prominent Jewish organizations, including the American Jewish Committee, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, known as AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish Federations of North America, and the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, denounced the report as libelous and inaccurate, an effort, they say, to demonize and delegitimize the Jewish and democratic state of Israel. While hailed by a handful of progressive Democrats, most on both sides of the aisle in Congress repudiated the 280-page report, as did the Biden administration and its nominee to be the special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism, Deborah Lipstadt. For years, U.S. and Israeli politicians have used the term apartheid to warn Israel of what it could become. Last week, Michael Ben-Yair, former Israeli Attorney General and a former acting judge in the Israeli Supreme Court, affirmed the Amnesty report. It is with great sadness that I must also conclude that my country has sunk to such political and moral depths that it is now an apartheid regime. Writing in the Irish newspaper The Journal, Ben-Yair concluded, "The status quo on the ground is a moral abomination. The delay by the international community in taking meaningful steps to hold Israel accountable for the apartheid regime it is perpetuating is unacceptable." Israeli forces assassinated three Palestinians in Nablus in the occupied West Bank last week. The three men were shot in their car by Israeli special forces driving a civilian vehicle. Israel said the three men were Palestinian militants responsible for recent shooting attacks. Thousands of people gathered to join the funeral procession of the three men, identified as Adam Mabruka, Ashraf Mubazlat, and Mohammed al-Dakil. All three were fighters with Fatah's al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. Protests against the assassinations took place in several West Bank cities and in Gaza City. The Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has called for an international investigation into the killings, which the PA cabinet described as a heinous crime. My guest today is Madeline Cherugino, Director of Government Relations at Americans for Peace Now. Founded in 1981, Americans for Peace Now is a nonpartisan nonprofit that describes itself as providing a pro-Israel, pro-peace American Jewish perspective. It is committed to a two-state solution and for more than two decades has called for the evacuation of Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories and for the establishment of a viable, independent Palestinian state. Madeline Cherugino, welcome.
Thank you so much, Margot.
Madeline, I'd like to begin by asking you to talk about the mission of Americans for Peace Now, the principles that APN has long supported, and the challenges these principles face today in Israel and in this country.
APN was founded as an offshoot sister organization to support Peace Now, or Shalom Achshav, in Israel, the oldest and largest peace movement in the state of Israel. in recent years, as Shalom Ashab has really focused their work on settlement growth and settlement tracking, and I encourage everyone listening to check out their Settlement Watch program, we've really tried to focus on bringing that message to the United States and representing American Jewish voices that are supportive of peace and want to see an end to this occupation. That's really where we spend our energy today.
The war 9 months ago in May between Israel and Hamas was sparked by events in Jerusalem, including Israeli efforts to evict Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem. Those efforts to push Palestinians out of Sheikh Jarrah and other neighborhoods in East Jerusalem continue. I'm wondering if you could explain the ferment going on in the city, what Israel is attempting to do there, and why these acts are seen as so destructive to any prospect for a two-state solution.
The events, like you said, were just one piece of what has been an ongoing effort to what we view as change the demographics in a very sensitive area. What we've seen in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan and other neighborhoods in East Jerusalem is this effort to buy old deeds or find old deeds from pre-48 that showed that Jews had been living there, or if not, purchasing these old deeds from former owners. And I think the issue that we find arising here is that these old deeds are being recognized by the Israeli government, while claims of old deeds owned by Palestinians in Israel proper are not recognized. So it looks to many advocates like a very one-sided legal system here and what's being recognized. Now, the practical matter of what's happening here is that Palestinian families are being evicted, forced out of their homes. We saw a demolition of a family just a few weeks ago of their home on a night that was quite cold, and it's very tragic, the Salia family. And we're looking at, you know, another potential eviction and demolition in only a few weeks now of the Salem family in Sheikh Jarrah. It's been an ongoing effort to change the demographics of East Jerusalem to make it more Jewish as a way to change the facts on the ground and to support Israel's claim to the entirety of Jerusalem and make it more challenging to have an eventual Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. And I think this really goes hand in hand with some of the efforts to build settlements in and around Jerusalem beyond just the eviction of existing homes. We saw a renewed effort to build in E1 in over the past 6 months. We're at a point now where that effort, thankfully, is frozen yet again. But there are these very sensitive neighborhoods. Atarot is another one where there have been ongoing efforts to establish new settlements that would encircle Jerusalem and further cut it off from any potential Palestinian state.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about what you just said. First, when you talked about the demolition of the home of the Salia family, when this happens, do these families have any place to go?
Your question really gets to the crux of a human issue behind this. I talk a bit about what it means for policy implications around a two-state solution. But there's also just the matter of a family that doesn't have somewhere to go. And it's the middle of the night and it's cold. And we're often looking at multi-generational homes. So it's not necessarily a situation where you can just go to, you know, the grandparents or someone else's home because you're all living together.
You mentioned E1. Talk a little bit about the significance of E1. What that term refers to and why it's regarded as so vital.
E1 is an area of land that has been undeveloped and it has been designated now for many years for development. There's been a very strong pushback against it, but under multiple American administrations, it's actually been considered a red line by many US governments. And that is because of the placement of this land. It is land that would be needed for the natural growth of East Jerusalem and to connect East Jerusalem to Ramallah. It also would stretch deep into the West Bank when you add in what the security perimeters would need to be if it were built up by Israeli settlers. It actually is considered a doomsday settlement should it be built up, because with that security perimeter, it would actually bisect the West Bank, making it impossible to have a contiguous Palestinian state.
Let me ask you about that. There are now hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers living in the West Bank. Israel has not slowed its push to colonize the West Bank and East Jerusalem during the pandemic, but has taken advantage of it to proceed with thousands more settlement units. Many experts say that the possibility of a two-state solution is long since past, was passed years ago, in fact. Is it credible, is it realistic to still speak of a two-state solution to the conflict?
I do believe it's not too late for a two-state solution. A large number of the settlements are close to the green line and could be brought into Israel with a negotiated land swap. So you're looking at a much smaller percentage of people in these outposts deeper into the West Bank. And in that case, yes, there would need to be an evacuation. But we saw an evacuation when Israel withdrew from Gaza and evacuated their settlements. It was not peaceful. It was definitely a difficult moment for Israel. But I believe that they are fully capable of doing this.
Israel has long been the largest recipient of U.S. aid, receiving $3.8 billion annually in military aid. In June, a month after the 11-day war in May between Israel and Hamas, the president of Americans for Peace Now wrote an opinion piece in Time magazine calling for U.S. aid to Israel to become conditional. An American who also holds Israeli citizenship and served in the Israeli army, Hadar Saskun, wrote of his long commitment to both countries and said, "What has become clear is that continuing to give Israel military aid without conditions neither serves U.S. policy interests, nor," he says, "does it serve Israel." He wrote, and I'm quoting here, "Last month's terrifying escalation of violence laid bare what has been abundantly clear for many years. The Israeli government has no intention of moving towards two states." End quote. I'm wondering about the significance of Americans for Peace Now calling for U.S. aid to Israel to be conditioned on Israeli behavior, just like aid is to every other country the U.S. gives aid to, and what blowback, if any, Americans for Peace Now faced because of that piece in Time magazine.
For us, and as Hadar articulated, we really view this as a pro-Israel position and a position that's right for American foreign policy as well. We know that sometimes friends disagree, and when you see something being done by a state that you don't think is necessarily in its best interest, I think it's your duty to, as a friend, oppose that. And whether that's through our speech or through conditioning aid and making sure that our aid is actually used to support our foreign policy objectives, our shared objectives with Israel for a two-state solution, whether or not that's, you know, necessarily being pursued by either the Israeli administration or actively pursued by the United States administration at this moment. We believe that taking tough positions in order to further this shared goal is an act of love. As far as blowback we received, we really were the first American pro-Israel organization, Jewish organization, to come out in support of this new position. And for a long time, I think the discourse has been really that of being a black and white issue, where if you support conditional aid, it must mean that you actually support cutting aid to Israel and cutting Israel's security aid, and you don't support Iron Dome or this and that. And that's not true. We absolutely support Iron Dome, and we support the state of Israel continuing as a state and receiving the type of aid it needs to defend itself still. But for us, we just want to make sure that that is aligned with our foreign policy objectives. As far as the blowback, there really hasn't been as much as perhaps you may have expected. Certainly, other organizations and other groups that would cross this red line and say they support conditioning aid have received it worse. But I do think that as we move into a point where the discourse around this is changing, I think there's more of an understanding that there can be nuance around this.
Could you say a little bit about how the discourse is changing?
The time of the war in May, you saw in Congress a arms deal that was up for review with Israel and members trying to push to cut this deal completely. There was a new energy around going so far as to consider cutting aid from some members of Congress. And I really believe it's changing. And now having conversations about conditioning aid or end use restriction is not a crazy idea anymore. And it's not considered an anti-Israel policy. While some from the far right will use the term anti-Semitism to attack anything they disagree with. It's not an anti-Semitic policy, and it's no longer being called that, which I think is really important.
Madeline, I know you're Director of Government Relations at Americans for Peace Now. Could you say a little about what you do in that role?
It's my role to work with the government. So mostly I work with Congress, but I also, you know, advocate in state governments as well to push for these policies that I think will bring us closer to peace. Now, whether that's supporting today, for example, the Lipstadt nomination and trying to make sure that we make it very clear that criticism of Israel is not viewed as anti-Semitism, or pushing back in the states against efforts to penalize Ben and Jerry's for their boycott and efforts to paint this boycott as a boycott of Israel and not what it is, which is a boycott of the West Bank and Israeli-controlled territories. That for us is really important. And it's unfortunately a lot of pushing back against unhelpful, if not dangerous, policies. But every once in a while, we get to push for something good too.
A lot of states have passed laws trying to penalize those who want to boycott Israel because of its settlement policies. So I take it then Americans for Peace Now is not opposed to the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement.
I want to be really clear. We do not support BDS, but we want it to be, one, clear that criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitism, and boycott is a form of protected speech. While we don't support it, it's your right to be able to boycott. To us, I think it's really important that these types of laws that are being used to chill speech and to chill criticism of Israeli policies are pushed back against. Back to the Ben and Jerry's part, there's also just the concerning element where states have painted this as a boycott of Israel, which it is not. And to us, it is very important that the territories are not considered in any sort of law as part of Israel. Any sort of conflation like that is something that we want to fight back against.
The Biden administration has been criticized for not doing more as regards Jewish settlement expansion and violence by Jewish settlers. It seems clear to some that the administration doesn't want to take on Israel or its lobby. Could or should the administration be doing more?
The Biden administration was very clear from even the campaign in 2020 that they were not going to come into the White House expecting or attempting to bring about another round of peace negotiations. From that time, we were really in a place of trying to just unravel the damage that the Trump administration did. I think it would have been pretty unrealistic to walk into it expecting to just immediately be able to resume negotiations when the United States needed to resume diplomatic relations with the Palestinians. And we still don't have a consulate in East Jerusalem. And there's other things that have been done that need to be unraveled. I don't think that they necessarily started out as taking a position of wanting to not necessarily engage. I think they were just taking a realistic position as to what could be engaged on. Now, there were a number of reasons why our ambassador was not confirmed until somewhat recently. And, you know, as we saw with many, many, many nominations to the Senate, there have been lots of holds and lots of politicization around these nominations. I wouldn't say that, like, some of the lack of engagement was by choice. We're very happy to have our Ambassador Nides there. But I do think as we moved into May and we saw the war that was in Gaza and all of the very troubling violence throughout Israel itself and the West Bank, I do think that the Biden administration could have perhaps spoken out earlier and more forcefully. There has been a sense that anything that we do as Americans could potentially cause the coalition to collapse, which I don't necessarily think is true, but I do know has been a concern among Democrats when it comes to pushing Israel and things like settlement expansion.
And you're talking about the political coalition that's in charge of Israel right now, correct?
Yes, because as we saw, this is our first time not having Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister in quite a while. And there's a real sense of relief and wanting to reset the relationship. So I think there was a lot more grace given to Bennett than perhaps was deserved, as we saw a real acceleration in an effort to settle the West Bank. And you know, Bennett himself has been very, very clear that he ideologically is very much in support of the settlers, which I think is actually different from Netanyahu, surprisingly. While he definitely had policies that emboldened these very, very extreme right wing of Israeli politics, it seems more as an observer that he was more interested in maintaining power than having, you know, pursuing a particular set of ideology. Of course, that aligned with supporting settlers, but I think it's very different with Bennett, who is a settler ideologue. I mentioned Atarot, which was a new proposed settlement around East Jerusalem and would fall into that bucket of doomsday settlements that I mentioned earlier. It was very clear that the Biden administration opposed this, opposed it even being considered, which because of our close relationship with Shalom Ashav and their work opposing these settlements in courts and all that, we understand that the best way to fight this is to keep it from being even up for consideration, because once it's up for consideration, even if you have a pause on something, it can be unpaused. The effort to prevent any sort of consideration of Atarot was very important. And the Biden administration, I know, was involved in conversations with Israel to express their disapproval.
I want to ask you about the report published by Amnesty International this month, charging that Israel is practicing the crime of apartheid as defined under international law in its institutionalized and systematic discrimination against Palestinians. The report came after 4 years of study, and it concluded that Palestinians across the occupied territories and in Israel are subject to an array of discriminatory laws meant to ensure Jewish domination. Israel immediately rejected the finding, as did the U.S. government, even though the finding corroborates other reports published by Human Rights Watch, the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq, also finding Israel guilty of apartheid. Various Jewish groups, including the Anti-Defamation League, immediately accused Amnesty International of anti-Semitism. What is American for Peace Now's response to the report by Amnesty International?
What Amnesty International highlighted, while we do not use the word apartheid and we do not consider it apartheid, what they highlighted is what we should be paying attention to. And what we've seen over the past now week and a half, is that people have fixated on the word apartheid and the usage of the word and have fully ignored the findings of the report, which is not a surprise to anyone that there's systematic discrimination against Palestinians, that there are two separate legal systems in the West Bank, that people are allowed to try to push Palestinians out of their homes in East Jerusalem based on a law that says that they can reclaim property, and yet Palestinians are not afforded that same ability to reclaim property. There's very, very clear, and it has been for many, many years, that there's a massive injustice happening. I think for us, what's important to focus on is that, not a word that people have clung to delegitimize the entirety of a report. We found it to be rather frustrating that the responses were to immediately go to things like anti-Semitism. It's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israeli policies. That's just not. We criticize Israeli policies all the time. And as an American, I criticize American policies all the time. And that doesn't make me anti-American. I think it's patriotic to want to push your country to be better. We criticize Israel out of love, wanting to see this state succeed, wanting to see it be better, and wanting to see Palestinians have equal rights and a homeland and self-determination and dignity. So I think the responses really missed the mark. The ADL response you mentioned, for example, a lot of these responses came before the report was even released. And I know that Amnesty provided an advanced copy of this report to Yair Lapid and asked to have a meeting with him to discuss these findings before presenting the report or publishing the report publicly. Instead of agreeing to the meeting with Amnesty, I believe Lapid then shared this advanced copy with these organizations. B'Tselem has had similar reports. Human Rights Watch has had similar reports. And it's truly the findings and not the word that it's really important that we focus on.
Yair Lapid is Israel's foreign minister. I want to ask you about religious extremism and intolerance in Israel, which we're now hearing more about. Just today, I read a story in the BBC about Jewish religious extremists dressing and posing as Muslims so they can worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the site of what Jews call the Temple Mount. Since 1967, when Israel captured East Jerusalem and the West Bank, Jews have been allowed to visit but forbidden to pray there. A kind of delicate status quo has prevailed, a status quo that seems to be breaking down. Violence by Israeli police at the Al-Aqsa Mosque was one of the factors that set off the last war between Israel and Hamas. Then in December, there was a report by local churches in Jerusalem that Jewish extremists were trying to drive Christians out of the Christian quarter of the Old City, or vandalizing churches and physically and verbally attacking Christian clergy. What accounts for the growth in religious extremism in Israel? Has it been growing, or is it just the media is paying more attention to it? What, if anything, is Israel doing to curb religious extremism?
This extremism is completely tied to settler extremism and the idea that this is your mission from God and is what is mandated from you to settle the West Bank and go back to where the Jews originally lived. You see that extremism and that violence tied so closely to it. My colleagues in Peace Now, they put out a report a few months ago now on settler violence. And it's quite alarming, the linkage between illegal outposts. And I'll be very clear, while under international law, settlements are considered illegal. When I say illegal outposts, I mean that these outposts are considered illegal by the Israeli government. So there are a number of illegal outposts where, you know, they are not allowed to build, and yet it happens. Oftentimes they don't get evacuated, and you see the most extreme settlers living there. And the linkage to this extremist violence and these outposts is quite phenomenal. You know, these outposts make up a small fraction of the number of settlements in the West Bank. And yet, little over 60% of what is reported settler violence occurs around these outposts. As we continue to see Israel allow these types of settlement building unchecked and allow the types of rhetoric, we have Itamar Ben-Gvir in Knesset as an example of someone who's really stoking these flames. And it doesn't surprise me that there's an increase in violence, unfortunately.
Do you think religious extremism is growing in Israel? And why do you think?
As we see these unchecked settlement growth and unchecked attacks against Palestinians by settlers, it emboldens people. If you see that you're not going to get in trouble for committing certain crimes, then you feel free to do it again. So I do think it's unfortunately a vicious cycle here.
Madeline Cherugino, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Madeline Cherugino of Americans for Peace Now.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.